Learn how to get funded with Nathan Beckard and BJ Lackland.
Pleased to be here. I'm BJ. This is Nathan.
Nathan.
All right. Well, listen, today the two of us are going to go through a talk here. It really kind of breaks down pretty simply. Basically, I'm going to be talking mostly about what you can raise, what securities and stuff like that. It's a little more boring, I think, than Nathan's part. I like Nathan's part better in some ways. He's going to really focus on how you actually do it, which is awesome. It's really actionable, sort of nitty-gritty on what you are going to be doing and such. So a quick thing about who I am. I've kind of spent like half my career on your side of things, on the side of things where I was an operator raising money. And then I spent about half my career on the investor side, looking for companies to fund and such. I was a VC back in the early 2000s. I was then an operator as a CFO of a public company, and then Lighter Capital actually were kind of a weird combination of both an operating business and a funding source and such.
Cool. So I run Founder Suite, which is a software platform that helps entrepreneurs manage their fundraise, do their investor updates, build their list of target investors. Been doing this about 2 years. We launched in January 2015 and raised our seed round about 6 months later. But before that, I spent 10 years as interim CFO at about 150 different companies. Some of them you've heard of, like Kickstarter and Clicker and Autonet, had some exits. And a lot of them raised money, and a lot of them didn't raise money. Spent a lot of time on the fundraising trail, so I've earned some scar tissue and some tips and hacks, so hopefully I can share those with you. First, we're going to start off with how to optimize your capital stack, which I think is really important.
All right. So like I said, I'm here to talk about sort of what you're going to raise or what the options are and how they kind of all work together. So like Nathan said, sort of looking at the capital stack means, for those of you who don't know what it is, it means nothing more than like, what are the different securities that fund your business, that make up your capitalization as a business, right? And the way that this is organized essentially is at the top, there's sort of the safest, cheapest money, often really hard to get for when you're starting out a business and such, all the way down to the highest risk money, sort of the highest reward, hopefully. And you'll notice, unfortunately, lots of you are, all of us are down here kind of thing, right? So that's basically your capital stack, and that's the way a lot of investors or capital providers will look at it and such. And that's kind of the way I want to go through it, is show you sort of from safest, cheapest money down to the highest risk money, what you're going to do. So starting off is the safe stuff. So senior debt. All right, senior debt. It's basically, in the startup world, most of the time you're thinking about folks like Silicon Valley Bank, Square One, Bridge Bank and such, who provide a lot of capital to startup companies. Now, unfortunately, you can't get that much money from them typically unless you either have money from a VC, because that's what they often look at as a signal that they could fund you, or if you get over typically like $4 to $5 million in revenues, then they'll start to look at you and such. As their bank, they need to be pretty safe. And the cost of money from them is relatively cheap. With fees and everything like that, you're looking at usually an interest rate that's somewhere in the single digits, plus some fees and stuff, you're looking at 8% type of money. It's the cheapest money you're going to find. So if you can get it, great. If you can get it and there's not a personal guarantee. Sometimes this happens with personal guarantee, and that's what the PG is, and so the covenants is, that means you're basically putting your own personal assets on the line. So you might be able to get money from Wells Fargo or a community bank or something like that to fund your startup. They give you $100,000, but they're also going to be looking at your FICO score and your the value of your home and your assets and things like that. So kind of a different kind of personal risk there. The next thing down the capital stack really is kind of called mezz debt. And mezz is just a fancy word for middle. It just means in the middle, okay? So mezz debt is sort of higher risk that is typically provided by non-banks, all right? So things like Lighter Capital, what we technically provide is mezz debt. We provide sort of revenue-based financing. It tries to be sort of the middle between debt and equity. It's technically mezz debt. It's kind of middle between debt and equity. Other sort of classic providers of things like this are places like WTI and Oryx and such. A lot of times, they often come in only after a VC has given you money as well, right? So when you're farther along and you've raised some VC money, you can see there's a lot of options open to you if you've done that. If you haven't raised VC money, then you typically are not first raising funds from either the senior debt or the mezz debt there on your left side. Over here on the right-hand side with revenue-based financing, what we do, it's essentially a term loan, but it's a royalty agreement. So it acts a lot like equity in that the faster you grow, the better we do as an investor. And so we like to provide it to companies because we think it aligns our interests with them in a way that kind of is like equity. And yet we don't take any equity. So we take no dilution. I mean, we take no ownerships. There's no dilution to the entrepreneurs. There's no ownership that we take or anything like that. And we think that's a good way to go. There's also no personal guarantees or anything like that on it. But it is more expensive than the bank. So, like I said, the bank is going to be the cheapest money you can get. So that's basically sort of some of your debt stuff. This is really your equity, okay? It's sort of equity. Obviously, over here, we've got convertible debt. Convertible debt is technically debt, but as many of you probably know, basically what convertible debt is in sort of funding startups and stuff, it's really basically unpriced equity, okay? That's what it's intended to be. Technically, under the law, it's debt. But essentially, it's a way of angel investors typically often use convertible debt, providing capital to a company, but not actually ascribing a valuation to the company. Because frankly, for angel investors and stuff in particular, it's really hard for them to go to you, the entrepreneurs, and say, I think your business is worth X dollars or whatever, right? That's just a difficult conversation to have. And frankly, a lot of angel investors don't really know what it's a fair valuation. Some are incredibly knowledgeable and know exactly what it is, but a lot don't necessarily know or they don't feel comfortable having that negotiation. Convertible debt is a really simple instrument, and that's one of the reasons why it's become really popular. It hasn't always been popular. Interestingly enough, when I was a VC, you hardly ever saw convertible debt. But it's become really popular in the past decade or so. Convertible debt's really simple. So basically, somebody gives you a sum of money, say $100,000, and you then have debt. You issue them this note. You have a law firm. Ideally, you got to use a law firm. So lots of law firms out there that would love to service you. But it basically says, hey, this note matures in some period of time. Entrepreneurs frequently make it 1 year. Don't do 1 year. Do longer than 1 year. Leave yourself options. Make it longer than 1 year. Tell the investor, hey, you really intend to be converting to equity, so why do you need a maturity date in 1 year? Push it out. Things always take longer than you think. Make the maturity date longer than 1 year. What basically it says, though, is this note will convert into equity in the future when you have what's called a priced round or a qualified equity financing. Typically, that means you're raising at least $1 million from some capital source, like a VC, that is actually giving you a price round. I mean, they're ascribing a valuation to the company, and they're saying, okay, your business is worth $10 million or whatever it is. Per share, it's a dollar or whatever, right? And the angel investor, whoever's invested in the convertible note, they typically get a couple benefits for giving you money today, but it not being valued into converted into equity until tomorrow, right? Those benefits usually come in two different forms. One is a discount. So they may get a discount to the price. So if the price that the VC says, let's say they say it's a dollar, and the angel investor gets a 25% discount, well, that means the angel investor is buying shares at 75 cents. Okay? So they get more bang for their buck, quite literally. The other common structure in this that's come primarily in the last 5-6 years or so, I think, is a cap, a valuation cap. That would say, okay, I'm the angel investor. I'm giving you $100,000 today. It's going to convert later. I'm going to get a 25% discount to the share price later. By the way, I also want to put a maximum share price in there or a maximum valuation for the company. You got to be a little bit careful about that because if you want to be really good about optimizing your capital structure, sometimes you can do things like take money from some angel investors, convertible debt. You're going to give them a 20 to 30% discount and stuff on the conversion. But let's say that they give you a valuation cap of $5 million, and you're pretty small, and you're like, hey, $5 million, that sounds good. But you can go on in the future and you do all kinds of stuff. Like we fund a ton of companies. About half the companies we fund have received money from angel investors, and the entrepreneurs want to put off having a priced round for another year or two. And we'll provide a company a whole bunch of money to sort of continue them on their journey. And so a lot of times companies will go on and they'll end up doing a first priced round with like a $15 or $25 million valuation. And then you're converting that angel investor's money at $5 million, which is really painful. That means they're paying like 1/5 or 1/4 what the VC is paying, which makes things hard. So you got to watch out for the valuation caps and such a little bit and just understand how they work. All right, so that's convertible debt. Preferred stock. Preferred stock is the sort of major thing that a true VC is going to be buying when they're doing a full-on, like a Series A or something like that. It's all preferred stock. And all the major terms for preferred stock, I think a lot of people think this is really mysterious. And actually, back when I was a VC, it was a little bit mysterious. But since that time, the National Venture Capital Association has come out with basically standardized documents. And it's a relatively standardized deal. They'll even show you what are the major sort of alternatives that you could see in your term sheet and such in there. But preferred stock is what VCs buy for a couple different reasons. Number one, preferred stock has certain privileges and such, certain rights that are greater than the common stock, which is what all the founders and stuff have common stock, basically, right? Preferred stock has certain rights and it has certain privileges, has things like anti-dilution privileges, okay? That's a really fancy word for saying, if your valuation goes down over time, they get more shares. A strange thing, but it happens. or it has a liquidation preference. A liquidation preference, a lick pref, as people call it, just means that they get their money back first. So let's say I'm a VC and I give you $5 million and you go out and you run your business, and no matter what valuation I bought it at, if you sell your company for relatively little, I'm just going to exercise my liquidation preference. I get my $5 million back first before any money goes to the common down here. The other thing is the preferred stock is convertible, generally speaking. If you're a VC, you're investing for the upside mostly, right? So liquidation preference kind of protects you on the downside, but you're really investing so that it converts. So convertible preferred stock is really the main instrument. But there are tons of different possibilities, tons of different terms and things like that. And you got to be really careful and make sure you have a really good lawyer so you understand that. To give you an idea, a typical term sheet for convertible debt or something like that is going to be like a page. A VC term sheet could be 5 pages of somewhat arcane terms and things like that. And when you actually go and sell the business, a lot of entrepreneurs are like, wait, that's what this means? That's not the time you want to find out what the terms were of your investment from someone. So especially if you're doing that, great, get a good lawyer. Then common stock. All right, common stock's obviously the very bottom of the capital stack, the most risky thing. It's what you're going to get primarily as a founder and such, or your co-founders and things like that. It's also what, if you're giving out stock options and things like that to your employees, those are convertible. They're options to buy common stock and stuff like that. So common stock's sort of the last thing to get paid. And usually there are no special rights or provisions around it except for what's given by law, right? So if you're incorporated in Delaware, Delaware has a bunch of laws around common stock and things like that. Okay, so now I walked through the whole capital stack. Is everybody asleep? I think the dog is snoring, but that tells me something. If I put the dog to sleep, that's really bad. Okay, so those are all the different securities. And you're like, great, fine, you filled my head with a bunch of stuff. This rather busy slide, actually, I think is kind of the more important one. This is how it all kind of works together, right? Because as you're operating a business, it's not a matter of, you know, today I'm going to go get some bank debt, then tomorrow I'm going to go do whatever. You kind of have to go with like what's available at your stage. And then, of course, with capital, one of the good and bad things about capital is it's a long-term endeavor together, right? If almost any capital source is, generally speaking, you'd be a long-term partner in your business. Whether it's debt or equity, they're still kind of a partner in your business, and you're going to be living for a long time. Equity, obviously, the longest, right? But so this is a slide that sort of tries to say, okay, how are we going to put all this together? What are the typically sort of, we call it the funding storylines that you're likely to go through in your business? So over here on the far left-hand side for you is sort of your stereotypical track, right? If you go read VentureBeat and TechCrunch and that kind of stuff, this is the track they tend to talk about a lot. It's a track where they're like often the largest dollars invested, and it gets a lot of news, and they have really good PR firms and stuff like that and everything like that because they've raised a bunch of venture money to do it. It's also the track that ends up with the smallest amount of ownership for you, most likely, right? So down here, somewhat universal, things like bootstrapping, family and friends, and the incubators, that kind of stuff can be moderately universal. Not everybody goes through incubators, and so angels, obviously, but it's sort of increasingly popular. So then on the VC track, you're basically on a series of, you're on a series of rounds of financing, each one called a series. And there's nothing magical, frankly, about series A or series B or anything like that. To be honest, you can actually name a series of preferred stock anything you want. You could name your first one series dog, your next one series K. You can do anything you want. There's nothing magical about it. Just A and B sort of became the convention. In fact, series seed is nothing but taking series A and renaming it seed. It's just all it is, anything you want. So series of preferred stock. After you do this, like I was saying earlier, you can get the tech banks or venture debt to come in. If you raise like a really a bona fide series or from a bona fide VC, you can often get some venture debt or something like that in there if you want. It's going to depend a lot on what your VC thinks, frankly. Corporate venture kind of is all over the place. We put it here because corporate venture has frankly moved down market quite a bit. You see corporate VCs more and more active in earlier stage businesses in the past 5 years or so. It used to be that you didn't really start getting like strategic investors and stuff until you were up in like Series C or beyond, but they've actually come down earlier a lot. A lot of it got funds and things like that now that are focused on that. But really, they can be kind of anywhere in here. Then Series B and Series C and off to the races with your series of things, D and E and whatever else. Okay, so that's one. That's sort of the well-known conventional path. That's also the path often that is... it's actually the least often path that's followed for most startups. By some studies, about 1% of startups raise VC funding. So it's well known, but it's actually not that well traveled. The other two, this is one we see a lot. So we do revenue-based financing. This is what we do. We see about 95% of the companies we fund do not have VC funding. All right. About 45% are bootstrapped and 50% have raised some angel money. And the companies will typically grow up to about $5-6 million revenue or so, and then they'll get one of the tech banks to come in and give them more money. And in a way, they kind of graduate. We'll help kind of boost them along for a while, and then they'll go off and raise money from a tech bank. And these are the kind of businesses, some of them grow up and are quite large and such. Some of them, you know, grow up to 5-10 million cell or whatever. But they tend to be the businesses where, like, the founding team still owns a vast majority of the business. A number of businesses we funded where the founding team still owns 80%, and the other 20% is the stock option pool. That's it. So that's sort of the pure, like, non-dilutive path. And then there's the blended version. The blended version has some advantages. You know, all of these have advantages and disadvantages, frankly, right? But has some advantages in that you tend to have a little more money in the bank, right? If you go and raise a VC round, you're going to be able to go and have some flexibility to really put your foot on the gas and such. Be more pressure to do that as well, but you're going to go put your foot on the gas. And you can unlock some of the money from tech banks and things like that to make it cheaper and such as you go along. And the advantage of this, too, is a little bit you kind of skip around in here. The most dilutive rounds to you, when you get to the end of the day and you've built your business, you've gone done multiple rounds of equity financing, whether it's angels, VCs, whatever it is, the one that often entrepreneurs look back on and they're like, hey, that investor was really important to me, but wow, they made a lot of money if you're successful building your business. It's the early stage stuff, right? I mean, that's who makes the big multiples on these types of deals. So if you can skip some of that, that's certainly advantageous. Okay, so what major considerations to think about? Like, how do you choose which one of these paths is best for you? The number one thing I always say is just have in mind what you want to do with your business, right? Like, what's your goal? I mean, are you trying to build the next Uber? Is it like, I'm going to be Airbnb or bust? Or is it like, I just want to make a great business and my partner and I or my co-founder, like, we just want to make a great business and we want to run this thing forever? Well, you know, those are two really different things. You want to make a big thing that's raised a whole bunch of equity money. You're not going to be running it forever because a whole bunch of equity investors that own slices of it and they need to get out at some point in time. If you want to run it forever, you're almost prohibited from raising equity in some ways unless you have people that are willing to own it forever with you. Anyway, that's one of the biggest things. Then obviously with equity valuation, everybody focuses on valuation a ton. In fact, I would say entrepreneurs focus on valuation too much. I would focus on some of these other things like culture and such with your investor. I mean, obviously valuation is important, right? But remember, especially with an equity investor, you're bringing in a partner. I mean, that person is literally buying a part of your business, right? You are being partially sold at that point in time and bringing in a partner. So you better like the partner and you better be able to work with that partner in good times and bad. Now, often at the point of investment, everybody's all rosy and happy and you don't know what bad times are, but you better feel like you can communicate well with that person as well as that firm. Right? Because sometimes it's as much about the person as it is about the firm. It's for that. So make sure there's a big fit and always push. Don't get too hepped up on valuation and such. Obviously, it's important, but I think it's overemphasized sometimes by entrepreneurs. Control is another one that's huge, obviously, and that really gets down to all those provisions, especially with equity investors, obviously, in a term sheet and such. You have a little bit of control issue sometimes with a bank funding because a bank will put certain financial covenants is called on your business. It'll say basically you can only lose so much money per month or this or that. And they kind of want you to operate between certain rails essentially. So thinking about control is important. And then value add, is the group really more than just money? And I think this is something that gets thrown around a lot. Sort of like, oh, we're value add. If you go read almost any website from any VC, somebody that they're like, we're more than money. We partner with our entrepreneur. I mean, you can almost just like recycle the same like stuff every single time. It really comes down to what you think and how you evaluate how, especially the person that's going to sit on your board, assuming one of them is going to sit on your board or whatever, is what are they really going to do to help you? Do they have some great industry contacts? Do they have some great industry insights? Things like that that can be really helpful. Anyway, risk tolerance for personal assets. It's mostly thinking about personal guarantees from banks and things like that. As long as time frame. Raising equity in particular is a long-term endeavor. Right? It's going to take you months and months and months, and Nathan will go into like the process of it, but it takes you a long, long time, generally speaking. Very, very rarely do businesses go into a VC's thing, and if you watch Silicon Valley, kind of like get all gruff and slam their fist on the table, and all of a sudden money is thrown at them. Like, it doesn't happen, unfortunately. And then exit strategy, like I said, think through what you really want to do with your business. How long do you want to be running it? Who do you want to control it? Who do you want as partners and things like that? That's incredibly important. So I think we'll do Q&A at the end as for that, but that's really the end of my time. So it's the right arrow.
All right. Thanks, BJ. So sometimes little drive, it really, really important because it impacts so many things like how much equity you own at the end of the game when you get acquired, right? And I mentioned in my bio, I worked with about 150 startups that were raising money. And some of those startups raised a lot of money, right? On paper, it looks great. They're in TechCrunch all the time announcing their Series C. But the founders, when they ultimately exit, had very little stock in the company and didn't make a lot of money. So understanding how that works, it's very, very important. So my talk is a little bit different. We're going to get into nitty-gritty tips, hacks, best practices on how to fundraise. Here's how not to fundraise. And here's how probably 95% of start to approach the fundraising game. Hunter Walk is a VC here in San Francisco with a firm called Homebrew. And I just love this tweet from like a year ago. Perfectly sums up what not to do. Most entrepreneurs get out there and they just start asking everyone they know, can you make some VC intros for me? Can you introduce me to some investors? And that fails for a number of reasons. One is it's too ambiguous. It's too broad a question to be acted on, as Hunter says. It also puts the burden of figuring out who you should be talking to onto the shoulders of whoever you're asking, right? Where that burden really needs to be on your shoulders. You're the one that needs to figure out who you should be talking to. And it's also just too ambiguous an approach. What we want to do instead is think about fundraising like a sales process, a structured approach. You hear this talked about sometime. Run your fundraise as a process. And if you think about it as a sales process, if you've ever been in sales, sales is a pretty structured thing, right? You start off building a list of leads, a list of targets you're going to reach out to. You qualify those targets. You make sure they're right for you. You don't want to be chasing everyone under the sun. You engage with those targets, and that we're going to get into the details how to do that. And then, of course, you're moving all those targets through your sales funnel, through your pipeline, ultimately either to buying shares of your company or to a no. And what I like about this framework is it removes a lot of the chaos and ambiguity and the frustration, especially for first-time founders around fundraising. Fundraising is extremely, I mean, a lot of people raise their hands when you ask who's raised money. So a lot of you know the pain of what it's like. If you kind of break fundraising into its constituent steps, it makes it a lot easier. All right, so step number one is building that funnel. And just two key points here. Fundraising is a numbers game. This sometimes is a bit of a surprise to first-time entrepreneurs that you actually have to talk to a lot of investors to get a good hand, folks, on your cap table. I say build about 100, 200 on that initial list. When we raised our seed round, I talked 200 investors and ended up with one seed venture fund and 10 angels, right? So, and I had been doing fundraising for quite a while. So it took me 200 investor discussions to get my round closed. And so if you do that math, that's about 5% conversion rate, 5% commit rate. And that's actually not too unusual, right? 3 to 5% conversion rate of the folks you're talking to also means you're getting rejected 95% of the time, 97% of the time. This sometimes is a cold slap in the face to entrepreneurs who get out there, start talking to investors, and they realize it's much harder than it looks like when you're reading TechCrunch. But if you kind of accept the fact that you're going to be getting rejected constantly, it makes it a little bit easier. That's normal. Okay, so this is the very abridged version of a longer talk I do, but how do we build our funnel? A couple different places to add investors to that list. AngelList is very useful. They've got about 23,000 investors in there. You can search by different criteria. It's mostly angels, but there's probably about a third VCs on there too. My platform, Founder Suite, we've got an investor database of about 50,000 names in there. You can search by market tag and location. And then we display the investors' social icons like Twitter, LinkedIn, so you can do a little more research. There are a number of paid sources out there like Mattermark, Crunchbase, CB Insights, PitchBook. So these are all paid ones. Some of them are very expensive, like PitchBook's 30 grand a year. Crunchbase is 30 bucks a month, something like that. And then a few other sources like PE Hub, VentureWire, Venture Pulse are all daily newsletters that report deals. So it can be useful to sign up for these. They're free for the most part, and you can pick out some leads. So it's kind of a process of looking around companies in your space, investors in your space, and building that target list. One other kind of tip for building your list that I do a lot with Crunchbase, like literally as I approach the fundraising process, I use Founder Suite, my own platform. I also look at Crunchbase a lot. I look at companies that are similar to mine, but not directly competitive. And I go look and see who funded them, add them to my list. And then in general, I do various kind of searching and scraping. of LinkedIn and some other sources. All right, so step number two is qualifying that list. This is really important. Again, kind of like I mentioned with the sales process, a good salesperson doesn't just get out there and pitch and chase everyone they meet. They actually qualify and prioritize their leads. And raising money, you should be even more diligent about this because, as BJ said, it's a 7-year relationship you're going to be having with these people. It's not a short transactional nature like a sales process. So a couple different reasons to cross investors off that list, right? We built that list of 150, 200. Now we want to remove anyone who's invested in competitors. Should be pretty obvious. To figure that out, look at Crunchbase, look at if it's a venture fund, look at their website, the portfolio section, see if they've invested in anyone. Look on their AngelList profile if it's an angel. No dry powder. If they're a venture fund and they haven't raised a new fund in the last 2 or 3 years, they're probably only doing follow-on deals in their existing portfolio companies. So you might either cross them off your list or deprioritize them. No recent deals. Same as the one above. If it's an angel investor and you look on AngelList page and you see that the last deals they did were in 2014, you might remove them from your list. Wrong sector, wrong stage, wrong geographic location. This is pretty obvious. It should be pretty intuitive to folks, right? If you're a fintech company, you shouldn't be chasing a medical device investor. But sometimes there are nuances that trip people up. For example, on the wrong stage, right? You're a seed stage startup. Find someone who calls themselves growth capital. That probably sounds good to you. You want to grow. That's the wrong fit. Growth capital means later stage, right? So there's some nuances you kind of have to tune into as you go through kind of filtering your list. And then bad reputation. This is tricky. There are some kind of shady, but there are some bad actors out there in the investment world, right? There's a lot of people chasing hot startups and some folks act unethically. There's a site called thefunded.com that has ratings and reviews on investors. It's pretty useful, a little bit out of date. If you're in an accelerator, great to run investors by your peers. We've actually had a couple accelerators, like 500 startups, use our platform to create like a shared communal board of like good investors and also identifying bad investors. And then finally, you want to be cutting this list down. I usually say if you built that list of 150 to 200 investors, you want to be removing about 20 to 30% of it, just as a general rule of thumb. That's usually how it shakes out. But you want to do this because it'll save you a ton of time and hassle down the road. When you're actually out there in the funding hunt, I've made this mistake too many times myself where I'll reach out to an investor, get connected to an investor. They say, sure, let's set up a coffee. I'll drive down to Sand Hill Road, an hour and a half in traffic, meet with them, realize right away it's not a fit because I didn't qualify them, drive an hour and a half back, and I've just wasted half a day, right? It's too easy to do that. So you want to be diligent in this qualifying stage. Step number three is figuring out how to reach everyone on this target list. There's a lot of confusion around how to get in touch with investors. The best way to do it, as you've probably heard from other people in the past, is getting your warm introduction. So how do you find a warm introduction? Plugging them into LinkedIn, seeing who you have in common, first or second degree connections, is the kind of default way to do it. There's a bit of a hierarchy in terms of mutual connections. If you have the luxury of having more than one person in common with the target investor, anyone who's made that investor money in the past is the best person to ask. Someone they've co-invested with the past, maybe another investor, probably second best to that. Third best might be a current portfolio founder. Fourth best, maybe an accountant or attorney who's met the target. And then the broader area under the bell curve is usually folks that Christoph has met once or twice, connected on LinkedIn. I have a lot of those connections. Those aren't great intro sources, but at least it's better than a cold intro. If you have zero mutual connections, what do you do? One approach is to look at Christoph's portfolio companies, pick out a couple of the founders that he's invested in the past, reach out to them with a cold email saying, I see Christoph has invested in you. I'd love to hear how it's been working with him. I'm interested in what he's doing, and here's why. If you get a dialogue going with founders, oftentimes you can then parlay that into an introduction. It takes a little bit more legwork, but it's much better than the last alternative, which is the cold email, which virtually never even gets opened, much less a response, much less leads to a meeting. A lot of investors have this screening criteria that if you can't reach them by way of a warm intro, you're not enough of a hustler to take you serious. So they often don't even open up those cold emails. The other context of that, why I always like to drill home why cold email is ineffective, is these guys are getting 200 warm intros a day and 400 cold emails. They don't even open up the cold emails. So I've seen startups do it and really try and do it en masse. It doesn't work. Okay, while you're in LinkedIn, map your connection paths to your target list. There's some other things you can do. So LinkedIn's changed up their interface just like a week ago, and it's kind of driving me crazy because I'm still trying to... You used to be able to go into your target, your own list of connections, and kind of pick out names from that. I don't think you can do that anymore. However, you still can search by the keyword investor and then filter by either first or second degree location, first or second degree connection, and location. So it's still a ton of results to sift through. You can apply a few more filters, but you can see basically in 1 or 2 degrees who you're connected to, and then from that, pick out a few more names to add to your target list. Okay, step number 4. So we've built this list. Let's just recap. We've built a list of 150 to 200. We've filtered it down to maybe 100, 125 really spot-on investors. We've figured out how we're connected to everyone, or at least as much as we can, everyone on that list. Now we need a tracking system to manage our fundraise because we're about to jump into the fundraise process. Google Spreadsheet, I used to build these for clients when I was consulting. It's obviously pretty easy to do. The problem is it gets super bloated like within the first week or so of fundraising. Hundreds of founders come to what we do and they say, I outgrew my spreadsheet, I need you. My quick little product plug is for FounderSuite. This is what we built. It's a Kanban board for managing your fundraise. So if you see the column titles, it's research, new, contacted, pitch, diligence, committed, or there's another column for said no off the side. And you can customize this in any way you want. Like I've got some custom columns in there, like no response, save for Series A. I've got some ways I'm pulling in intros from my advisors and investors. I've given like an advisor their own column. They can come in there, add their connections. But whether you use a Google spreadsheet, whether you use FounderSuite, whether you use some other sales CRM that you're familiar with already, you need a way of keeping track of all the discussions you're just about to have. By the way, my last little plug on this is we launched this about a year ago in March of 2016, and startups using it have raised over $130 million. So there's some market validation on that. Now it's time to actually jump into it, and you got to have your peptid pills handy because there's going to be a lot of turbulence ahead. But what we want to do is basically start asking our connectors for those intros, and we want to do this pretty much at the same time. We'll cover that in a bit more. This is an example, a real email I used to Jeff Thomas, who actually works here at NASDAQ, very connected guy. I went through his entire network. He had like 700 investors in his universe. I picked out about 25 that were relevant for what I'm doing, sent him this email to quickly skim and see if he knows anyone on here well enough to make that intro. He wrote back and he picked out about 6 names off that list and said, sure, I can do these 6. The other 2, I don't know very well. Mamoon's not relevant for what you're doing. You're too early. Zaw, I don't know well enough, right? I mean, he kind of qualified a little bit. But contrast that approach of going through his network, picking out relevant ones, asking him for the intro, to that first slide I showed you about just if I had gone to Jeff and said, hey, Jeff, can you make some VC intros? You know, I might have got a couple from him, but instead I did a much more laser-focused approach, and it was a very effective approach. So for each person that Jeff says, yes, I can make an intro, I send Jeff a custom email, a clean, new, fresh email. I don't recycle the thread Jeff and I have been having, but I sent him a new email saying, Jeff, can you introduce me to Target? Kind of a sexy subject line. Remember, these guys are getting 200 warm intros a day, so you want to have a good subject line in there. At this point, we had an investor already on board. If we didn't, I'd probably have a good little traction blurb in there. You want Jason, the target, to open this email from Jeff, right? Anyway, you don't need to get too worried about the exact content. The key is that it should be super short, briefly kind of describe what you're up to, and then optionally include a link to your pitch deck. Some people don't like to put their pitch deck in the first email. I typically do. I do it about half the time because I actually want to pre-qualify Jason, again, the target. If Jason clicks on my pitch deck and clearly not fit for him, I don't want to waste time setting up a meeting call, everything else, right? So I like to include the deck. Some people want to have more gradual reveal. But really the whole point of this is, again, don't get bogged down in the details of the text. It should be short and should be easy for Jeff, our connector, to simply click forward. Jason, do you want to take the intro to Nate? Send. He does that 6 more times. It takes him 10 minutes to make a bunch of intros for me. Jeff's a busy guy. If I had made this more complicated, saying, hey, Jeff, can you make some intros to me? It would have never got done. This process makes it really easy, and it'll get done. typically. I'm still waiting on BJ to make some introductions. Putting him on the spot. Public shaming. I'm just kidding. So a few more tips on this. Doing the intros in parallel. So what that means is you've got your list of 100 or so targets. You want to be asking your connectors for those intros in a fairly condensed time frame, right? I call that the blitzkrieg approach. And what we're trying to do here is get momentum going around your deal. The best way to get momentum is to be having lots of meetings. Hopefully those meetings are leading to progressively more detailed meetings. Investors can kind of sense momentum. They can sense desperation, or they can sense a deal that's getting stale and dragging out. It's great when you can go into a meeting, pitch meeting with an investor. They always ask, so how's the round going? Where are you at with the round? You're going to get that almost every meeting. That's their slightly veiled way of asking, do you have momentum on this deal or not? Do I need to act faster or not, right? That's what they ask. If you can say, the round's going good. I've just started, but I've got 2 more meetings today, 3 tomorrow, and 4 on Friday. That investor that you're just meeting with is going to be kind of paying a little bit more attention to what your deal's going, right? If you say, I've been fundraising since August, different story, right? We're looking to get momentum. So second point here on the pitch. Ideal scenario, you're going out, you're meeting with 2 investors a day, maybe 3 if you're really super ninja. You're meeting with those investors, you're coming back at night, and you're spending an hour revising your pitch deck. Every meeting you have, you're going to get signals about what parts of your pitch are clicking, what parts where you're losing people. By the time we actually raised our seed round, I think it was on version 42 of our pitch deck. Like, we literally made 42 different versions of that deck. And it was very different than what I had started with. And it was very good. At the end, it was a killer pitch deck. But it really takes those live meetings to hone your pitch deck. Final couple parts here. Leverage VCs off each other. Again, once you start to get some momentum around your deal, you kind of signal that to the investors you're meeting, which makes everyone move a little faster. These guys and gals are driven by greed and FOMO, fear of missing out on a good deal, right? So to the extent that you can get that FOMO going, it's great. Even with momentum, though, as BJ mentioned, raising equity capital usually doesn't happen overnight. It's usually over a couple months. So you should be sending a monthly update to everyone you're talking to. Everyone who hasn't said no, even if they haven't really responded lately, you should be sending a regular update. And of course, FounderSuite has a tool for that. But even if you're using MailChimp or something else, you should be doing that. It's a very good best practice. And just to emphasize that a little bit more, I had a VC meeting last week. It was from 1 o'clock at 1:58. They said, you got to wrap it up. We have another pitch starting at 2. These guys are meeting with startup 5 or 6 hours a day, 5 or 6 companies a day, 4 or 5 days a week, 20 companies a week. So you need to stay top of mind with them, which is why you need to do the monthly updates. Let's see. I think that's everything in there. And then finally, a couple tips for kind of closing it. This is the hard part. You've got momentum going, hopefully. Your pitch is really clicking, right? You've tweaked those slides that you started to lose people. You've got some slides where people are doing the head nod or leaning forward, whatever body language it is that signals they're getting what you're doing. Now we want to bring us all in. At the end of every meeting, I make this a conscious little trigger in my brain to actually ask them, so what do you think of this deal? You know, are you interested? A lot of entrepreneurs don't ask that because they're in there kind of giving their pitch and then they walk out. Actually ask them for their interest. They usually give you some coy answer, non-committal, like, oh, I'll discuss it at our partners meeting. But if you can leave there with a next step, a next meeting, some due diligence follow-up, maybe customer references, they want to see your pitch deck, they want you to send them a forecast, whatever, that's a good sign. So you want to try and aim for a next step for every meeting. Point number 2 is make them chase you a little bit. And again, I have to remind myself to do this every time because it doesn't always come natural. But every meeting, again, I ask them, so if we were to do a deal together, how do you typically help your portfolio companies? And in particular, how would you add value to FounderSuite? What would you do for us? Make them pitch you a little bit. Changes that power dynamic a little bit. Too many entrepreneurs go into these pitch meetings sort of hat in hand, begging for money approach, where no, it should be the other way around. They should be chasing you if you've got something worthwhile. Point number 3, it does take numerous meetings usually before you get a term sheet. As again, general rule of thumb, it's about 80% of your time and effort will be getting that first term sheet. Once you get that first term sheet 2 through 5 are usually a little bit easier to get. And of course, as you're starting to get more term sheets, it creates that momentum and you can drive it all to a close. All right, number 4 here, following up frequently. This is one of the numerous frustrating parts about fundraising. You'll have a great meeting with someone, you think they're about to write a check, and then you never hear again, and they don't respond to your calls or emails. it can be hard to get a no. It's in investors' best interest to not say no to you, right? Because the door's still partway open if they don't say no. There's optionality around that. I usually follow up about two or three times with an investor. If they still don't respond, I move them into my column on my Founder Suite Kanban board. It says no response. You want to be moving people through your funding pipeline, right? That's the whole point. You're trying to move them from contact to pitch into diligence or move them off their board into a no or no response. When someone does say yes, this point down here, PG handshake protocol, say you're out having coffee with an angel, maybe it's your second meeting, they say, you know what, I like what you're doing, I'm in for 50K. You go back to your laptop, you type in, awesome meeting you, just to confirm you're in for 50K, please write back. If they write back and say, yes, I'm in for 50K, then you can move them into your committed column. If they don't do that, they're still a lead, right? It's kind of a way of moving them through your pipeline. Handshake deal protocol from Paul Graham of Y Combinator. And then finally, this last point, obvious on the surface, but don't let up until the money's in the bank. I mentioned I worked with 150 companies. We've got about 1,300 companies on Founder Suite, all fundraising. I talk to a lot of these people. I know where they're at with their rounds. I see a common mistake, rookie or veteran, where you're a CEO, you've been fundraising for 2 months, it's going okay, you think you have enough momentum that it's gonna carry itself over the finish line, so you go back and attend to all the pressing customer support product things you wanna be doing, and then some angel drops out, another investor drops out, and your funding round implodes and collapses. I've seen this happen so many times. So the point is, keep your foot on the gas pedal all the way until you actually have those wires cross into your bank. That's when you can go back to doing your normal job. So yeah, just to summarize, run it as a process, a nice structured process. Work your network, but doing it efficiently, right? You're going to be asking for a lot of favors. Hopefully you've been paying it forward for years, and now it's time to collect those favors. And then it's a numbers game. It really is a numbers game. Unless you are someone who's had three companies go public and you've just graduated from Y Combinator, you're going to have to talk to a lot of investors. It's simply the way it is. And you're going to get rejected a lot. So I think with that, let's see.
Oh, sort of my lesson. So my quick things on optimizing your cap structure is skip a round of equity if you can. It's going to be really diluted for you, especially in the early stages. Try to be capital efficient how you run your business. Obviously, the less money you use, the less you have to raise, the less you have to go through all this pain and dilution. And then don't limit yourself to VC. There's a lot of different money out there. VC sort of grabs the headlines of stuff, but there's a lot of different money out there that you can go and tap into. Sometimes it takes even longer to go to non-traditional sources, for sure. But there's a lot of different money out there that's interested in funding all different kinds of businesses and stuff like that. So make sure you're looking under a lot of rocks.
That's it.